VIP. Let's kick it.
This has nothing to do with anything, but this story will make you laugh, I think. Y'all know who Brent Lane is, my good friend Brent Lane, who hosts our sister station's morning show Cat Pack on 98.7 Cat Country. So this is like I've come to believe this is the only song he knows all the words to, because this is the song that he always karaoke's 100% of the time when we do karaoke, and it's hilarious. It is also my wife's favorite karaoke song. And she knows all the words to a lot of songs, but anyway, so Brent and my wife have this exactly in common, that they love them some Vanilla Ice. 638 News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Joining us now, we have Alex Andrade, our state representative for District 2, the southern half of Escambia County, plus Gulf Breeze and the beach. Alex, welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, good morning, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Final week of session, right? I mean, nothing's going to happen this week. It's boring.
Yep.
No overtime.
No, it's completely boring. I actually pulled off at a rest stop on my way back over to Tallahassee this morning to have this call. The news last week was that it was announced we'll be coming back for an extra special session in mid-May just to discuss the Seminole Compact that Governor DeSantis signed last week.
So can I be honest with you? I track a lot of things doing this job. Every time the gaming stuff comes up, my eyes glaze over, and I try to remind myself why I'm supposed to care or follow, or just to the degree that you know that going in, explain to me why this matters and why I should care in Pensacola.
Well, Florida's had a pretty stringent ban and regulation on gambling, in large part because of the type of tourism industry that we have. And, I mean, there are metrics that show that instituting or expanding casinos and gambling tend to harm the residents of your specific state and send money out of state. But we've always had a compact with the Seminole tribe to regulate gambling and to operate gambling in Florida. That compact results in about $500 million a year coming to the state budget, or at least this new one could potentially do that. And one of the key components of that is a potential expansion of sports betting here in Florida. And a lot of analysts believe that Florida is uniquely situated to be kind of the nationwide leader in sports betting. So it's something that we'll be discussing. When we have a special session like we will on this one specific topic, that's the only topic we can discuss. So it'll be heavily debated and discussed going into our May 17 special session.
Well, it sounds, the way you describe it, it sounds like all upside. What's the concern?
Well, I mean, the concern is about fundamentally changing the character of Florida tourism, right? So depending on exactly what the compact says, I haven't read through it yet. It could change it could add to the reasons why people might visit Florida, but it could also have a negative societal effect, if we expand gambling here in different ways. But, I mean, the big net effect financially, obviously, is $500 million additional dollars in state revenue every year. And the contract also provides for increases in that payment from the Seminole tribe above $500 million if these new kind of, these new markets do expand and are successful for the tribe.
How does it work? If you guys make changes to it, does that then go back to them for negotiation? I mean, is this an active negotiation between the legislature and them? How does it work practically?
From my understanding, I mean, we could reject it with specific instructions.
Okay.
Or we can ratify what the governor negotiated and signed.
Okay, so this is not you. This is not you amending. This is not you hammering out legislation. This is up or down with notes.
That's my general understanding. I've obviously never signed off on a compact. These occur, once every 20 to 30 years. So obviously I'm 31 years old. I don't believe one's been signed more than, once in my lifetime previously. So this will be a fun experience for me to learn through.
Obviously you and I talk quite a bit about the bridge, because the bridge runs between your district, Gulf Breeze and Pensacola, and of course affects your other part of your district in the Pensacola Beach. Are you still on board? Do you still think they're going to hit the date? And more to the point, what is being done? I know you wrote this letter requesting an audit to the governor's office. You've been very involved in these calls and all of that, I understand. But what's being done? I think people want to know what's being done to Skanska or with Skanska at this point.
Well, Skanska is still having their liquidated damages provisions being levied against them every day, north of $30,000 every day the four lanes aren't open on that first span. Right now I'm working, I had a call last week with Commissioner Bender, DOT and the Department of Economic Opportunity working on trying to reduce or completely subsidize the cost of the ferry system that's coming online with Hornblower coming back into town.
Pause there for a second, Alex. I saw you post that on Instagram last week. I didn't know what you meant, and I failed to ask you about it last week. When you say subsidize the ferry, you just mean the route that's going to run from Pensacola Beach, the Sound Side, over to the Pensacola Terminal. You're not talking about something additional like making a stop at Vista Park and Gulf Breeze or anything like that, right?
No, nothing additional.
Okay.
That decision was made months ago. But if we can use that as the type of commuter ferry, we will. So I'm working to make sure that we've turned over every single rock to try and get that done. Got an update from DOT last week. They're feeling extremely confident that by mid-May, they can almost have traffic on there. They haven't revised their estimate because they're being very conservative, but they're very confident that because all the trophy pieces are in, all the spans are in, they're just laying deck at this point, but they're going to meet their deadline at the very least and potentially have two lanes open before that estimated deadline. So it's very comforting to hear that those trophy pieces and spans are all in. And that the four lane could even come back sooner than originally estimated.
Dwell on that for a second. I mean, don't just throw that out there and then move past it. You're telling me that, and I look, you know me, I will believe it when 1,000 of us have driven across it, okay? But you're telling me that that where we are with the trophies, the main hardware is all in, that decking, which is the quickest thing, the easiest thing to do, that's just the concrete surface on the top, that's what's left to be done. And they are saying, without revising their official estimate, they're saying, yes, definitely Memorial Day, possibly earlier.
Yeah. I was on a call last week with Commissioner Bender, and the engineers at DOT are very, very confident at this point. Again, always with the caveat, if you don't believe me, I don't blame you. But all the indicators are there to say that we'll have this bridge open at the very least by the end of May.
One of the issues that came up here recently, Commissioner Doug Underhill alerted us to the HB 53, which also has an identical or very similar Senate companion. This is the one that would say that if we are hiring local as a local preference, like covenant with the community kind of stuff, that we would lose eligibility for state funding for any of those projects. Is that the right understanding? And can you maybe unpack this for a second?
So I think it might get a little bit over dramatized by the folks that might have brought it to y'all, but essentially, if you're using state funding, over 50% of state funding in a project in Tampa, you cannot require a headquarters of a company to be in Tampa. You can't require a specific training of folks in Tampa because these are state funds. So, covenants with the community are incredible, especially if, one county wants to have that preference from the tax dollars that county levies. When we're talking about statewide funded projects, the metric becomes different. You can't take state funding and then suddenly, play kind of a, home field advantage and act like it's your money as a county to mess with. So there's a balance there to be struck. And while I support covenants with the community, I believe that, Florida-specific contracting with state dollars is something we can absolutely pursue. It's good for a community like ours, who gets far less of that margin of money, to think in those terms, because we have big contractors, too, that can go bid on projects around the state, and they get harmed if a community like Miami-Dade or Tampa or Orlando is giving preferential treatment to companies in Tampa, Miami, and Orlando.
Okay, so this would only be with contracts that involve more than 50% of state money, and it would also allow us to prefer Florida businesses. It just wouldn't allow us to prefer, you know, Escambia or Santa Rosa businesses or something like that. Okay, I get it. We'll talk about this some more. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you about, I know you're not a state senator, and I know the House is apparently not on board with this, but the Senate unanimously voted to extend the duration of unemployment benefits and also the amount of unemployment benefits at a time where every business owner I know cannot find employees and says they have people showing up to check the box to say they filled out an application so they can keep their unemployment going. What is wrong with the Senate? Why is it? Help me understand.
Well, it's not necessarily what's wrong with the Senate. It's what's wrong with the argument. We have Democrats right now, tearfully, crying crocodile tears, saying that we haven't done enough to support individuals in Florida during our initial response to COVID-19. My argument is that we've done better than almost any other state in reopening and allowing people to go back to work and seek gainful employment. We see this argument as kind of an end run around kind of a universal basic income, this kind of socialist kind of ideal of, if we just give people enough government money, they'll be able to be happier. There are help wanted signs in every single storefront. My county, Escambia County, is desperately trying to hire people. They have a ton of unfilled positions, and yet somehow we're still talking about unemployment benefits when the unemployment rate in Florida is incredibly low compared to other states in the middle of COVID-19, and we've done a very good job of getting reopened. I actually was the only one to stand up and ask that question. I said, listen, to a Democrat member who was tearfully pleading for extra money for unemployment, I said, you represent an area of Orlando that's a service-based economy like mine is. Do you not see the help wanted signs in every single storefront? And I was vilified by Democrats for asking that simple question. It's a bizarre situation for us to be in. We all know that we have a ton of people right now not actually looking for work. And while I believe that everyone was entitled to unemployment benefits if they were laid off by their employer during our response to COVID-19, we've reopened as a state. And the frustrating part for me is that some people don't seem to realize that. So, no, I won't vilify the Senate for voting to expand it, but the House is not on board with that. We see in our specific districts help wanted signs everywhere. And we need to be just getting people back to work, giving people opportunities to support their families again, like we've always stood for.
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, I thought the Republicans controlled the Senate still, but whatever. Okay, so fair enough. Alex Andrade, he is our state representative for District 2. Alex, I always appreciate the time, sir. Have a good last week in Tallahassee. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew.